Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is musician and entrepreneur Scott Page. But first, let's talk about Groove Shark. I don't know if any of you have ever used Groove Shark, but it's basically a music delivery system. You go online to Groove Shark, you put in the song that you want, and in fact, it will search and find it for you, and it'll actually find multiple versions. It's just like any other streaming music service on demand, but it's illegal because it hasn't been paying license fees to the record labels and it hasn't been paying royalties. The fact of the matter is, though, it's been around for 8 years, and who would have thought it would have taken that long to be shut down? Yes, the major labels have had lawsuits, and it's only been last week that finally a ruling came down that said that Groove Shark had to immediately shut down, or else pay a $756 million fine, or actually just in license fees, to the record labels. Well, that wasn't possible, so what they did is they shut down and put a very nice apology letter on the site saying, we did a bad thing, we were wrong, and I'm sorry. So many words. The founders were also charged with a $75 million fee if they were to start another version of Groove Shark again. So imagine that. You have your life's work that gets shut down, for better or for worse, for right or for wrong, and then you can't even start another version of it, or else it'll cost you $75 million. Well, that being said, guess what? Within a few days, Groove Shark comes back. Only instead as grooveshark.com, it comes back as grooveshark.io. And in this case, it's some anonymous employees that get together, and prior to being shut down, they sort of get the feeling it's going to happen. So what they do is they back up everything, or at least 90%, what they say is a figure they give. Then they wait to see what happens. And of course, it gets shut down. So then they decide that they're going to do this anonymously. So they put it back online with the majority of the content, meaning all the songs, the playlists, everything. You can now go to grooveshark.io, kind of get whatever you want. Now, the point of all this is the fact that it's really difficult to shut something down that's illegal. You can use all sorts of legal means, but the fact of the matter is, it takes a long time, and even when you think it's shut down, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's shut down for good. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this in the future if Apple has its way and strong arms the streaming networks into eliminating their free tiers. And that's what Apple's trying to do behind the scenes. It's trying to get rid of Pandora for free. It's trying to get rid of Spotify for free. It's trying to make it so you pay for listening to your music. That'll work for some people, but let's face it, most people listen for free and they like doing that and they feel it should be free. So what we're going to start to see is a lot more Groove Sharks should that happen. I don't think it will, actually. For one reason, the Department of Justice is looking into it in the United States, and also the European Union regulators are looking into the fact that there may be an antitrust case involved here. So just the threat of that happening with record labels, because the record labels are complicit with all of this, of course they don't want the Department of Justice snooping around, because there's always been so much that's kind of cagey with record labels, especially how they pay royalties or don't pay royalties. So I'm not so sure that we're going to see this, but if it does happen, don't be surprised if piracy shoots up like crazy and we see more sites like Groove Shark. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I'd like to talk about is the fact that there's been a new study that's done by the Imperial College of London. And this involves a number of engineers and biologists. What they did was they looked at 50 years of the Billboard charts, 50 years of the Billboard Hot 100 to be specific. And this amounted to about 18,000 songs, or about 86% of the hit singles in that 50 years. What they did was they built a computer program that looked at the timbre and the harmony of each song. So why do they do this? They wanted to find out the evolution of popular music. And what they found was that there were three major eras that happened in popular music. The first one began in 1964. Now, automatically, everyone thinks the Beatles, the Stones, the British Invasion. But it turns out that this revolution had started prior to all of that happening, prior to the British Invasion. In fact, this particular era was outlined by loud guitars, lots of major chords, and no dominant seventh chords. That was in the era before, where there's lots of dominant sevenths, but suddenly, in this particular era, they're gone. So this started a little bit before the Beatles got here and the British Invasion got here, but it was the first really big change in popular music. The second one came about in 1983, and this was basically the era of synth pop and of new wave, but also of heavy rock with lots and lots of chords. One of the things that they found, that the study found, was that a lot of these particular songs, the synthesizer-based songs, sounded pretty much the same in terms of the harmony and the timbre. So you might want to say that that was a boring era of music. But the next era was the most significant out of all of them. And this happened in 1991, and in fact, this was the introduction of hip-hop. Well, there's a whole bunch of things that happened here. The first thing is basically rhythm-based, and of course we know that, but also there are no chords, where before we had lots of them in the previous era, now we have basically none. But really what makes this the most significant of the three eras is the fact that the cultural change that came with it. The first thing was that it reflected the culture of the times, but also it helped change the culture as well. So as far as being a significant era, just the fact that the impact hip-hop had on the culture made it the greatest of the three eras, according to the study by the Imperial College of London. So that's pretty interesting, the three eras of the music business, at least of the popular music business. The one in 1964, the one in 1983, and the last one in 1991. My guest today is Scott Page, and he's played with some of the biggest bands in the world, including Pink Floyd, Supertramp, and Toto. But he's also been a super successful entrepreneur as well. Scott has started a number of tech companies, including the cutting-edge Seventh Level, which became the darling of Wall Street and even went public. I spoke with Scott from his home in Glendale, California. So Scott, thanks so much for being with me today. I really have been looking forward to this for a long time because you're such an interesting guy. There's so much going on in your life.
Oh, thanks very much. Actually, Bobby, thank you very much for having me.
So
really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's go back to the beginning here. I read someplace that your first appearance, professional appearance, was on the Lawrence Welk show.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, my father was in that band, one of the early members of that band. And I grew up in the Lawrence Welk musical family. So I'd done, you know, varieties of years. We'd always have the Christmas shows and they'd have the families on. And probably every year I played trumpet in those days, I would do the show. And so we did things that were kind of wild. Actually, one of the shows, my dad and myself, we water skied. And I played my trumpet, and he played two clarinets on the Lawrence Welk show. So, yep, that was my first kind of inkling into getting into the music business was doing those shows early on when I was a kid. And it was pretty wild.
Boy,
it was a lot of fun, actually.
It's a big change between Lawrence Welk and, you know, the hardcore rock and roll that you eventually got yourself into.
Well, it's kind of funny because one of my claims to fame is I'm the only guy that played in Lawrence Welk and Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So there you go. that's a kind of an interesting twist.
How did you make the transition from trumpet to sax?
Well, let's see. You know, through the years, I studied to be an architect through school, through, you know, going from junior high school, I was studying drafting and then went into high school, was doing that. And actually, I took up trumpet when my father had done a was doing, he actually did one of the very first videotape shows ever. It was called Music Man Take 10, and Kahn Musical Instrument Company was the company that sponsored him. And I remember coming to the house one day before they shot this pilot they were doing, and there were all these brass instruments, and I started out and I saw trumpet and kind of fell in love with that. So I took up the trumpet. And I played that all the way through junior high school and high school. I wasn't very serious about music at all. I basically did it because my dad, you know, always advised me, said, hey, we can always get a gig on the weekend, you know, beats working in the gas station, pick up a few extra bucks. So I kind of did it for him through those years. And then as later on, what really got me into the music business is I got into a band with Jeff Beccaro and David Page. We had a kid band called the Merciful Soul Band. You know, David and Jeff were from Toto,
yeah.
Right, the original Toto guys.
Yeah.
And we started winning all the battle of the bands. It was like a Chicago blood, sweat, and tears type of band. Had a horn section, so I was playing. I was the worst guy in the band playing second trumpet. But then I finally realized that I loved the music business so much that, you know, I was drinking coffee all day. I was working for a company called Audiodyne at the time, drawing, you know, exploded views of parts and things. And that's when we had to use pencils and pens before we had computers. And all of a sudden we're starting to do these battle of the bands and we're winning them all. And all of a sudden there were girls and there were lots of them. So I said, you know, I think I like this music business thing much better. So I switched and jumped into the music business full force. And I got very fortunate to, my dad was also after Lawrence Welk. He was NBC staff. And he worked over there in the Light Hopper season. He was doing a television show at the time called The Loman and Barkley Show. And that was on NBC. And there was a guy by the name of Stan Werth who was the conductor. And his claim to fame was he's not only a great conductor, musician, but he wrote Super Chicken and George of the Jungle, if you remember those.
Yeah. Things. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so anyway, he asked me to, you know, I joined his band. He was playing a club called the China Trader there right in Toluca Lake, not just across the street from Patty's, just down the street from Patty's where we were the other day. And I got in his band and I was playing trumpet and I actually played a little bit of flute at the time. So he said, well, if you could pick up some saxophone and maybe a little guitar. So I started doubling on those instruments. And from that, I got really hooked on the saxophone and just really started diving into that full force, you know, as I got into college, well, actually right after college. So that was a kind of this transition. The trumpet, that thing, I call it the coil of torture, one of the toughest things to play on the planet. So since then, I've been really focused on playing guitar and saxophone. Those are my main instruments, yeah.
But boy, you changed late in life, though. For someone as good as
you know,
I mean, usually when you're really good at something, you've started pretty early, but you switched late in your life.
Yeah, it was funny. I was going to college and I was, like I said, I was studying drafting and all of a sudden this music thing and I just completely changed everything. And actually I used my drafting skills because I said, well, how can I make a living in the music business and still be able to kind of learn? Cause I needed to study because I was not that good at the time. And so, I actually started doing music copying and took that up. Because in those days, we didn't have, you know, the computers actually spitting out. We had to do it by hand.
Yeah.
Guy would hand you a score, and you would, you know, you'd look at the score, you know, and you'd write each line out by hand. And I started working for H.B. Barnum. Do you remember him?
Yes.
H.B. by any chance? Yeah. So I used to work for him and a variety of guys, and I was doing music copying because my skills were good because of my drafting. So it's, you know, that's kind of where I, you know, really got into that as I was studying. And then I ended up studying with a guy by the name of Lyle Spud Murphy. Spud Murphy developed a whole system called the Equal Interval System, composing and arranging. So I just really immersed myself in music at that point and was, you know, trying to play as many club gigs as I could. I was trying to work six nights a week and then just, you know, studying music and practicing all day long and became a fanatic. So yeah, it was kind of late in life, but, you know, it worked out pretty well.
When did you start a tour?
First tour I did was in a band called Max that we opened up for a band called Mahlo. I don't know if you remember him. That was
had
a couple hits. That was George Santana.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so we did a tour and we had a horn band called Max and it was a pretty smoking band and we cut a couple, did one record. And that was kind of the starting the first thing. And then my first big tour then was Seals and Crofts. And that was back in 77, I think, 77. And we toured the world, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and all over Europe and all of that kind of stuff. And so that was my first real tour. And then from that, I had varieties of different tours. You know, I was with Supertramp for quite a few years, did multiple tours and albums with them. And then one day we were doing an album at Supertramp, and Dave Gilmour from Pink Floyd came over and did put a solo on the record. And that night I happened to be playing at a club down the street with my band. I had a band called Just for Grins, and we would just play, and it was all great players. You know, Mike Finnegan was playing B3, and Jeff Baxter was playing guitar, and Kenny Lewis and Steve Miller's band. And so it was a great little band. So I invited Gilmour over that night to come hang out. He came out and hung out with us. Then I told him about a project I was working on that I was doing a week later called Push Back the Walls, it was called The First Dance, which I was doing at Guitar Center. I'd been working on a whole idea of sound and picture called Visual Sound, where all the players wore lavalier microphones, and we created a MIDI-based tripod system so that when the cameras would zoom, it would change the level, so it would bring up the presence. You know, that lavalier would come up a little bit in the mix. So you're really making sound and picture work together.
Yeah.
We invited him down to this thing. We did that. Had a 45-piece band there and inside Guitar Center, believe it or not. And next day, Dave came to that night. The next day he called me up to come, you know, to come to put a solo on the Floyd record. And then from that point on, I ended up joining up and played with them for a while, which was great.
Well, Supertramp was pretty big, but...
Oh, yeah, it was great.
But Pink Floyd was another level completely.
Yeah, that brand is really so powerful. I mean, we used to laugh all the time. You know, we have our laminate pass, our backstage passes. And that was like we called the key to the universe. That brand, no matter where you were in the world, anything you needed, if you whipped that card out, you'd get in the door. You know, you'd go into the restaurant. Oh, the place is sold out. Sorry, sir. Oh, I see your... Oh, no problem. Right this way.
Wow.
It was like the key to the universe. It is a very powerful brand. And yeah, no question. Pink Floyd was really something.
Was it different playing with those guys than with anybody else? Is there anything different? Was there like a different discipline or something? That's kind of what I'm getting at. If you looked at like Supertramp or Toto or anybody else you played, did you see like a big difference when you got with Floyd?
You know, it's just the kind of the cultures were different in all of those bands in a sense, you know, just the vibe. Mm-hmm. Supertramp, very family oriented. You know, each of the guys held positions in the band and managed specific things, and all the families, everything was very like that. And, you know, and it was just a really wonderful family kind of vibe. Toto was obviously very technical. It was a lot of fun. I mean, those guys were, you know, insane, and we had a great, great bunch of time. And I got to say, you know, people ask me about Toto. I said, when you played with Toto, what was that like? What was the best thing about playing with Toto? And I said, I got to play cowbell on four tunes with Jeff Beccaro. That was the most fun part. Because, I mean, you know, one of the greatest groove time masters of all time.
Yeah.
So that was always a blast. You know, they're all different in their own sense. I wouldn't say there was really much different there. I know Floyd was just so grand about everything they do. Everything they do, you know.
Yeah.
I remember Gilmour. I remember when we rehearsed. I took the gig and we went to Toronto. We rehearsed in an airplane hangar at the international airport, and they used to have to shuttle us out in little shuttles out through the over the runways to get to this big hangar out in the middle. And all I can remember is I'm going in there. I'm seeing, you know, flying saucers and flying pigs and massive lighting systems and this just huge production, just like nothing I'd ever seen.
Yeah,
I mean, the production was massive. And I remember asking Dave, he says, you know, if you make it grand, they'll come. This thing. And I said, man, it was grand. Because, you know, we had full surround sound. You know, they do quad sound in stadiums. And, you know, they were crazy with the amount of gear. I remember looking, there was like one time I remember looking at the laminated passes. I remember, I think I saw somebody with one that said number 160. So it was like there were so many people moving that around. And there was like 60 semi-trucks pushing that thing around with all the steel and traveling. So that, as far as a grand tour, that was where it was over the top. amazing group of guys. And I love Gilmore. I mean, he's like one of the guys that I really learned a lot from, you know, because he's just a master of melody.
Yeah.
So I really tried to study what he does. And, you know, I used to love going out and standing in front of his amplifier when I play it, because I play guitar and played rhythm mic on Comfortably Numb and those. And I just stand there and he would just play. And I loved it because his tone was so beautiful and it never hurt your ears, even though it was really loud. So it was just a, you know, great experience for sure.
Yeah, he's so lyrical too, and that's the cool part. You know, so many guitar players just want to whip it out, and although he's capable of it, boy, he's just so melodic and so lyrical. That's why everybody loves him, I think.
Master of melody.
Yeah.
Master of melody, no question. Yeah, and he would even kill you when he didn't play in the spaces that he left.
Yeah.
I really liked a lot, and he was always, what was great about Dave is he knew the important licks and things to always bring back that their fans would know. You know, he didn't like always just kind of play all over the place. He was really smart about the melodies that people would really recognize and making sure that they were there all the time to satisfy everybody. You know, but what a great guy, man. I love him.
That sounds like a great experience. And
oh yeah, it was really something.
So how did you go from that? I mean, that's kind of the top of the mountain there when it comes to gigs, and then you kind of make a left turn and you become an entrepreneur. So
yeah, that's interesting. Why did that happen? It's funny. I always tell this story. People ask, you know, while I was out on the road, when I was a kid, I always had a vision of doing three things in my life, my career. I wanted to do music. And then after that, you know, I always wanted to get into business side of things. So I knew I had a business side that I wanted to do. And then the last thing, which is funny because I'm working on now, is documentary. So those were the areas. So as I was out on the road with Pink Floyd, Dave used to look at me and kind of laugh as if he said, "What are you reading?" I said, "I'm reading, you know, In Search of Excellence. I'm building me a business, Dave." He'd like kind of laugh, you know, kind of music guy. I said, "No, I'm gonna start me a company." So I took the opportunity while I was on the road to study business as much as I could, knowing that I was going to do something when I got back. In between the tours, I actually started a company called Walt Tucker, which was named after my two heroes, Walt Disney and Preston Tucker, the car manufacturer. And I loved them because of their pioneering spirit. And I built an audio video post-production facility and had a graphics merchandising business. And in that business, we did a lot of the post-production stuff for a lot of music videos. I partnered with a company called The Company, and we did, you know, everything from Rolling Stones to Janet Jackson to, you know, Garth Brooks, and, you know, on and on and on. We did a lot of that stuff, but I really loved the business side of it. And so I was really studying. So in between tours, that's what I did. And then, I did a project. I started working and I did my first CD-ROM project for a company called ProSonus, and it was the idea of music to be used for presentations to people who had computers, right? So it was licensed music that you could use under your presentations for, at that time, most of the Windows computers in those days. And so that was my first thing. I saw this whole world of technology coming on, and Jeff Baxter, you know Jeff probably, right?
Sure,
Star player from the Doobie Brothers. Yeah, so Jeff and myself went to Comdex. And I was sitting there, we were demoing our product, and I looked across the room and I saw this this computer, and I'm like, what is that? And I walked up to it, and it was a title called Just Grandma and Me. And it was a children's title, like maybe 5 to 7 years old. But it was the first kind of animated where you clicked on things. You know, it was an interactive book.
Yeah.
For the first thing, I said, man, this is the future. You know, this is where it's at. So I actually took everything I was doing and really started focusing in that space. And I started hanging out in the cyberpunk scene with all these, programmers and garages and stuff. And, you know, it always helped at the time that I'd just gotten off the biggest tour in the world with Pink Floyd. So they were all happy to have me come in, which was great. Great entree. Thank you. Thank you, Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And I just really got involved in the technology, saw that side. And then I did this big event in Las Vegas with this partner that became my partner at the time, George Grayson, with a company called Micrographics. And we put on this event that had 18,000 people during Comdex, which is a big trade show. And the whole idea was really to bring Hollywood and Silicon Valley together. And we basically traveled for a year pulling this together. And I brought, we had the, you know, probably the largest lighting system ever. It was the Genesis system plus the Floyd system. Wow. Plus we had, you know, reality engines, all the technology. I brought all the technology. We had all the cyber people building things mixed with Hollywood. And I had Cirque du Soleil. I had, you know, Graham Nash, John Entwistle played from The Who. We had, I had Mark and Brian, the radio person who hosted the show. We had the first 3D kind of talking heads, Charles Fleischer, the voice of Roger Rabbit. He did that. And I had, we had the first circular video walls, Nevada Symphony Orchestra. It was a massive multimedia show. And Bob Ezrin, you know Bob, who actually produced Floyd and was there. Bob called me up and said, what are you doing? He's read about this thing. And I told him about this show and I said, I needed some help. And Bob said, all right, he came over, saw me and he jumped in board. And boy, thank God, because Bob saved my butt basically on that show, you know, being such a great producer.
Yeah.
And really helped me pull the thing together. And during that, we both stood in the middle of the room and said, man, this is about, it's so exciting to feel all this energy at the technology business. And here we're bringing all this Hollywood. We started to start a company together. So we took actually my company, Walt Tucker, along with George Grayson. We came together and we created a company called Seventh Level, which was all based on technology, entertainment, and educational products. And 18 months later, we took that public. So that was my foray into the real business world. After having my small production company, we then started going into this whole CD-ROM thing. So it was a wonderful time in those days. And we actually was really proud of the fact that our product, we did a product called Toonland, which is a children's educational title, which was the first interactive cartoon ever done. And it actually ran on Windows. And Bill Gates used to use that product on his at all his keynote speech showing, saying, see, Windows is a good multimedia machine, because in those days everything was about DOS.
Right.
And Windows was a pig. So it was like, I remember it was so funny because we were dealing with 4 mega RAM, you know, and 2.5 mega that was Windows. So you had 1.5 meg to deal with and you had to figure out how to make cartoons for stuff. So it was pretty fascinating time. We had a great engineering team that built an engine that ran on top of Windows and we had a great ride with that. It was a lot of fun.
Seventh Level was very cutting edge, very pioneering. A lot of people that aren't either weren't around back then or aren't really into multimedia history aren't aware. But you were really pushing the edge there the whole time.
Yeah, we were definitely the darling on Wall Street at that time. You know, in the Wall Street Journal all the time. I'm actually proud I got one of those little, you know, those little cuts. They got the little dot pictures that are in the Wall Street Journal. There's some famous thing about that, and it's pretty cool that I got one of those on top of that. But, yeah, it was a very cutting-edge company. We were really on the leading edge. We were winning. We won probably, I think it was over 125 awards, and we had some of the biggest titles at that time ever. Out there. So we were really on the forefront of all that. And it was really interesting. That's what really got me into the technology side. Cause I'm kind of one of those guys that I bridge the gap between the creative guys and the technology guys. Cause it's just the brains work so totally different. You know, the technology guys are all about it's on or it's off. It's yes or it's no. There's no gray area. Artists, we're always putting our thumb up. Ah, it could be a little better. We'll massage it over here. You know, it's a little bit gray. We live in the gray area, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's always a fight between the two. And so I really got a real good handle on dealing with, you know, the technology guys and been able to kind of translate that stuff. So we did some very interesting products at the time, very cutting edge, and we kind of really pioneered it. Probably one of my biggest claims to fame that I love, that I'm really proud of, is I've been a book called 50 Pioneers of Multimedia. Along with, you know, Nolan Bushnell and Jared Lanier. I actually was considered one of those guys in that day. So it was a really, really fun time.
That's very cool.
In that space.
That's a great honor. Tell me about when Seventh Level went public. What changed?
Oh, you know, well, first of all, it's like Ed McMahon showed up at the door with a truck of money, which was insane. I'll never forget how that was. That was just crazy. You know, you go one day where you've been just like, you know, pounding, you know, trying to build your business, putting every penny into it, and all of a sudden, you know, the whole market, you know, everything changes. You know, you have a, You finally have the capital you need to be able to execute. There's a whole set of respect that comes along with that. So it makes it easier to, you know, get in the doors because now you're running a legitimate company. It's crazy, but it's one of the toughest things too. My partner used to say it's almost like putting pins and needles in your eyes because you have to deal with so much regulations and so many investor things. And so you have to have a full team of people that are just managing that piece of it all the time. Yeah. But, you know, it was really a fun ride. Never gone through that. It was definitely way interesting. I learned a lot about Wall Street, I can tell you that. Very interesting.
Would you do it again?
You know, I think right now, you know, with the other business, everything, I'm more about, I think, getting acquired is really the route I would take now. Because now with the regulations, even more with Sarbanes-Oxley and all these other things that are, it's just very difficult to do that. And I would rather find somebody else that would acquire us that already had all that in place. And it's really a big deal. I mean, there was 30, 40 people just drafting on the drafting committee. Just writing the documents to be able to go public. I mean, it was massive. I mean, it's an incredible, you know, hurdle to get over. And luckily, my business partner at the time, George Grayson, this was his second company. He'd done this, so he had been through it already. And that's, like I said, it's a very complex process. And it's fascinating at the same time. And it's a gig, no question.
Well, that brings you to considering that you have all this technology experience and more since then, but that brings us to Ignited Network, which is your latest brainchild, which is very cool. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. I just realized because I've been working on launching a variety of tech companies since, you know, the Seventh Level days. And, you know, I've been doing Ken Rakowski's radio show every week as pretty much as the music mentor and working with artists. And I just started to realize that, artists don't realize that this is the greatest time in history for them. There's no question in my mind. I mean, I've lived through the old school music scene and this one, and without a doubt, this is the greatest time, mainly because I can now have a direct connect through, you know, a two-way communications collaborative network, you know, using your cell phones or whatever. I got a direct connect to my customer. And at the same time, I can take the order. I can actually make a sale and I don't need any middleman. So that opens up a lot for an artist to be able to start build their own business. Now, because everybody can do that, that's the problem. So the good news is everybody can do it. The bad news is everybody can do it.
Yeah.
And so it causes a whole series of issues. There's just such a glut of just tons and tons of music. And we all know music's pretty much free these days.
It is.
In a sense. Yep. It's pretty much free. It's hard to make any money. I mean, I heard a statistic not too long ago, and I have no way to verify this, but I've heard this, a couple of people talking about CD Baby, that, you know, like something like 85 or 90% of the people on there only make less than $30 a year off their music.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
So it's really tough in that sense. But I got really excited about the opportunity with what I'm calling the rise of the artist middle class. And we're already seeing people starting to do this. I mean, there's YouTube stars that are cleaning up. There's people building direct-to-consumer businesses. And so I just realized after doing this show that all the artists, they can make something, but they don't know what to do next. And there's all these new principles and things that are happening, the lean startup principles, ways of creating businesses and take the risk out of it, where you're testing, iterating, and failing fast so that you can, you know, make sure you're not using your resources. And we now also have the ability to find an audience because we know through data and growth hacking, we know exactly who your audience is, when they're online, we know when they're in the buying habit, in the buying cycle. So we have all this data now through big data and everything that can really help us determine what we do. So combining, you know, startup business principles, because I believe every artist needs to be is really a startup business, using those principles, using, the arts of storytelling and how we build and, you know, use those data points to find your audience and, you know, using conversion techniques and all these things that we've now have data to tell us what works and what not works. I decided to build a business that's very similar to the Y Combinators or the 500 startups, you know, out of Silicon Valley. Now, if you're not familiar with those are startup incubators, usually run by very successful entrepreneurs, and they're looking to find companies to invest in. So to reduce the risk, they find artists. You basically crowdfund an artist. I'm not an artist, but an entrepreneur. They like them. They bring them into a program. They run them through a program to validate their business model, their idea. And then if they like it, they'll fund them. So I saw that and I said, you know, this is a great strategy for artists. So Ignited Artist is an artist accelerator that follows a very similar model. The idea is we look for people to submit artists based on a certain criteria. We're looking for leadership. We're looking for artists that have leadership that want to build a business. This isn't about just being good. This is about looking at the art of business as much as the art of the music. And so we're looking for those special kind of individuals that have that kind of mindset. The idea is we look for them, we build out our whole board of mentors and producers and top people to vet the artists, and if we like them, we bring them into our 90-day program. Our 90-day program is really a combination of, if you think about the process, it's kind of Shark Tank meets the Apprentice meets The Voice. And we put them through a whole series of tasks and all that, and if they get finished, then we fund them. We fund their business, we say, all right, let's go. So we have a fund. It's set up to fund artist-owned businesses. We set up their business. We actually set up a C-Corp for them, put a cap structure together, and then we have financing and things that we can do to finance the artists. So it's a whole idea about building these artist-owned businesses. And it's really about a different strategy of not so trying to be so broad, but going after niches. And, you know, I'm focusing, and I'm sure you know the 1,000 True Fans strategy model. It's been around for a while, the idea of 1,000 fans, if you get more, and a true fan is somebody who'll spend $100 a year on you, if I have 1,000, and there's my first 100,000 in revenue. And we're actually going to a new model now, which is really based on relationship-based products. And so I believe this is really the next thing. It's not about just putting a piece of music out there and hoping and praying somebody's there. People will pay for the relationship and the experience. They're looking for experiences and things that solve problems and educational pieces. So there's ways to rethink the model for artists. And so, you know, our accelerator is all about putting them through a process. Through this 90 days, we really figure, we do a full business plan on what you're doing, and we use the Lean Canvas and the Lean Startup model, the one-page business plan strategies out there, along with all these different things. We bring mentors in and people and teams, and each artist has a full team set up around them as they go through the incubator. So the idea is that they have all the skills that are necessary to be successful. So I'm very excited. We're getting ready to do our first one coming up here in, looks like late July, early August. And I think it's a wonderful time for artists to build a business. And our model, what we like about our model is it's very artist friendly. So the artist should get the lion's share of the money, which is totally different than the model that's been there for a long time. You know, it's never been really favorable for artists. It works well. You know, the big labels will work great if you become one of those 0.02% of the market leaders. And that's great. But if you're kind of caught in the middle there, it doesn't necessarily work out so well with all the creative accounting practices they do with the money and debt and everything that you do as an artist. So we want to build a new model that is very favorable for the artist, that they, as their business grows, they get the lion's share of the money. And it also allows us that they're their own business. If they set it up, we can scale. So we're like an unlabel. Our company then is all about what we call Ignited Insights. And Ignited Insights is all the data science and the strategies and product and all the things that they're going to need and market fit and things that we can help our partner companies to grow. So we stay there all the time with them to really make sure that those products and stuff fit the market and help them grow their business. This way I can scale. I can have thousands of artists on our platform. We have a platform that's also being built that has all the CRM and crowdfunding and stuff built in so that they can actually really grow and build their business and use the power of the crowd, because there's no question that is probably one of the most powerful things that's there, you know, with our managed street teams and all those kind of things. So we're taking a new approach to this business, focusing on what's working out there, using the data and the science to help us determine what we're doing. I mean, it's like I try to tell artists, even if you look at their website, you're going to put up a website. You don't want to put up just a website. You might as well look at what the sites, how they're designed, the science behind them to convert. Because at the end of the day, if you're not converting your fans into paying customers, it's a hobby.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, a lot of them aren't even thinking about converting. And that's the big problem. Because, you know, let's face it, musicians are musicians first and business people way second. So it's actually changing the mindset. Or actually, it's different because you're finding artists that already have the mindset, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's actually there are some out there, you know. And the main thing is they just need to learn how to figure out and really build a business. Like one of the artists we have is cleaning up on licensing, did seven figures, did over $1 million in licensing last year.
Wow.
But he's smart enough to know that, you know, his style of music is good right now and it's happening, but that's not going to last forever.
Yeah.
And they're out there touring, they're doing things, but they really haven't figured conversion strategies yet.
Yeah.
I mean, artists make the biggest mistake, they play gigs and they aren't taking advantage of being in front of people to really move those people into their camp and then move them through a traditional conversion funnel, you know. And it's not about you. It's got to be about the fans, and you've got to create value for them. And there's certain things you do. And it's interesting, once you build those relationships, boy, they'll support you like crazy.
But,
one of the models that I think, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the models that seems that I'm really focusing on, and there's a whole new thing this whole new idea of the intent economy and a new model called DRM, where you have CRM,
yeah,
customer relations management. Now it's coming to vendor relations management. The model is let the customer set the price.
Yeah.
And so we're experimenting with that. We had one artist that was selling their stuff on iTunes and, asking people, I said, take it off, give it away for free and say, pay me what you can. As soon as she did that, she started making some real money. Because what happened is the people that really cared, she'd have some people write her a check for $500.
Yeah, yeah.
For that same record, because they want to support the artist. So if you can figure out how to create a lot of value and let the customers pay for it as they see fit, I think that's a very powerful, powerful model that needs to be experimented with more, and I think has real value for the arts.
Well, of course, Radiohead did that, 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and did very well,
correct,
as a matter of fact. And then actually came out with the CD afterwards through EMI and still went platinum or triple platinum, I think. So it just goes to show you that, in fact, that can work. And I've actually been really curious why they haven't followed that up. You know, you'd think it worked once. Why wouldn't you do it a second time?
Yeah, I have no idea. Maybe it has to do with are they on a label again? Or, I mean, I haven't heard much from Radiohead lately. Have they been doing anything?
I think they're off of EMI now. So I think they're, mm-hmm. and it could have been, again, some sort of legal thing that's stopping them. I don't know, but, and what was interesting was they're on EMI, yet they did this. So it was, how they pulled that off, I don't know. And maybe it was EMI that actually stopped them, anything afterwards. But it's a great strategy. And you're right. It's one of those things where you rather have people give you something rather than nothing. And you'd rather have people, if they can afford to subsidize you and they really want to, then at least there's an avenue for them to do that.
Yes. On the new platforms that are coming out, I'm sure you talked about Patreon, everybody out there, which is a great model.
Yeah.
And I love that idea because you're creating a whole slew of different types of products that people will pay for $1, $5, $10 a month. And what I like about it especially is our model with Ignited is we have to create a repeatable process. I got something to work. How do I keep repeating this process so that I can think? What I love about that is it forces the artist to have to be repeatable.
Yeah, sure.
Because if people are paying you on a monthly basis, then you have to deliver.
Yeah.
And what a value are you delivering and how are you doing it? So it puts you in a different mindset because in reality, all artists, we're broadcast networks, right? We can build our own channel basically. And what we have to do is attract users to come to that channel and then figure out what you give them a value that they're going to pay you. And anybody can do that. And if you're clever and you really look at the science and the data and all the conversions and things that are working and how these work and the strategies that are working, you can be very savvy and and make it work for you too. You know, I mean, there's, especially now when you start looking into the behavioral science, like the hooked model, you know, where you've got triggers and, you know, the, you've got variable rewards, and there's a whole process that gets people to move and make things happen. So savvy artists will start to pick these things up and take advantage of this. That's what Ignited Artists is all about, is really staying on the forefront of the latest technologies, giving the artists the platforms they need, and then delivering all the data and stuff that they need. So it's a new way of thinking. It's like, again, it's your label. We're there to help you and support you. So it's kind of a hybrid between a record label and an independent label, kind of an idea.
You know, what's interesting is internet marketers have learned all these tricks, and they've been using them very successfully. And I've actually taken a number of courses just so I could get hip on this. And I got to say, they, as you say, it's down to a science. They know that exactly what funnels are going to work. There's the whole theory of the 13 different funnels and you know, the interconnecting parts to them and whatever. But those things have worked. They've always worked. And there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. All it is you're selling a different product. But, you know, music hasn't been hip to that yet, and it's very cool that you're doing that, and you're actually bringing those techniques, which now, in the market that we live in, and since we live online, since everything we do is online, that's what you have to follow. You can't do anything else because the traditional, you know, the traditional market isn't there, or at least the majority of it, what's there is so small that, you know, it's not, if you're going to be successful, you can't just concentrate on that.
No, it's very difficult. And you, if you want to, you know, eventually, I mean, I think labels, major labels there's a place for them in the model, but that's after you've built your audience, you own that audience, you've got your product flow. Now you maybe want to blow it up and even go further. And then, you know, a major can definitely help you there, especially on a worldwide kind of a, you know.
Yeah, that's what they're good at. They have that infrastructure. And it again, reinventing the wheel on that level is really difficult, really expensive. So you might as well take advantage. But it, you know, if you get to that point, going through Ignited, you're in a much better position to strike a better deal at that point. So it, you know, works in your favor.
That's the plan, because let's face it, all the labels, everybody else now, they're looking too. They want to look at your numbers.
Yeah,
because they're looking for artists that are already engaging with their audience already. You know, generating revenue, and they're going to use the same kind of, you know, look-see to see what you're doing. Because what they're looking for is, again, artists that don't have to be babysat all the time and can make it happen. And then they come in and they want to swoop in and make it, you know, they'll help you take it to the next level. So, I mean, every artist, whoever's out there, you've got to pay attention to building your brand and building your audience. Because that's going to have a big part of, you know, what's going to happen for you in the future. And, you know, now we have all kinds of ways to build audience. That's where we're growth hacking and strategies get in place. You know, there's all these new techniques and things that we can do to grow and build and find and target an audience, which changes the game big time.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's always nice to put your product in front of somebody that wants it, you know, as opposed to just somebody that doesn't want it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's great times.
Tell me about the documentary you're working on.
Oh, okay. So, over the last 50 some years, I've been putting away, I've been collecting my memorabilia. I shot 150 hours of footage on Pink Floyd. I've shot tens of thousands of photographs. And so I basically documented everything I've done, knowing that one day I'm going to go back and pull it all out. So I've just been filling up. I had a full storage unit, plus my house is filled with just tons of stuff in different closets and rooms, and I just now pulled it all out. And what I'm doing is taking all of that and putting that into a sort of a documentary style thing. I'm not doing it in the same sense as a documentary right now, where I'm putting together, like putting an hour piece together, but I'm pulling it together on varieties of stuff that I have. So one of the things that I'm doing is, with 150 hours of Pink Floyd, I never saw it. Right. I shot it, put it away. So I just had it all digitized, and I'm watching it all for the first time. And what I'm doing is, as I watch it, when I find a section that I went, holy cow, what I'm doing is I actually got myself one of those Samsung Notes. And the reason I got that phone is because you can shoot forward and backward at the same time.
Yeah.
And they got a little spot there. So what I'm doing is, because I don't have time to edit all this, so I've got it set up. So I'm shooting my computer screen and I'm shooting myself so I can comment. I can be commentator on the product.
Wow.
And it's just crazy because I've seen it for the first time too.
Yeah.
So I'm just, as I'm watching it, I'm commentating and I'm just talking about it. So I'm building those pieces right now and I'm planning on putting a bunch of those out pretty soon. Just finished a 6-part series on my experiences with Pink Floyd. A guy contacted me for one of the big Pink Floyd sites out there called Brain Damage. And we put a very extensive kind of 6-part long blog series about the whole experience and a lot of photographs and videos, a lot of these videos. So I started doing it for that. So that's going to be my first piece that I'm going to put out is some of this Pink Floyd stuff.
Wow.
That's the kind of types of things. I'm just going to release it all online.
Yeah.
And that's my goal, just get it out there.
Wow. Sounds fascinating.
Yep.
And it must be cool for you. Again, you haven't seen it before, so it might be cool. It must be cool to go back and look at it for the first time and go, wow, I remember.
Oh man, it is. I'm telling you, it's like I'm reliving my life.
Yeah.
It is the wildest thing because I was relentless with it. Everybody thought I'd be like, oh, you do it, shoot it for a day. Well, we were out for 2 years and I shot it every day.
Wow.
Like just, you know, shot and shot and shot. And I've got some incredible moments on tape.
I bet.
But I just happened to be at the right place at the right time and captured. So I'm pretty excited. But I know the fans are going to love it.
Absolutely.
Because it's just a totally different view of the band and from different perspectives and things, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it should be interesting.
Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either received from somebody or you've learned along the way?
Advice, I would say the thing that I'm most excited about right now in the world of business is the lean startup movement. And the reason I say this is some of the greatest advice is because it is a process to build a business that helps you reduces a lot of the risk, and it allows you to really formulate your idea and test your hypothesis to make sure you're doing the right thing. Because I can tell you, I've started companies, I've done now probably seven, eight companies, I guess. Had some successes, a couple of them failed, and it was very painful. And the ones that failed were always because of the same thing, because I never really tested my idea properly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you get what they call the founder's dilemma.
Yeah.
You can see the thing, oh, everybody wants this. I know this is the greatest idea since sliced bread. I know they're going to love it. If I build it, they're going to come. And the biggest advice I can tell you, don't do that. Do not do that. Stop. Go back. Go get Lean Startup. Go read the Lean Startup book by Eric Ries. Then go to leanstack.com. And there's a thing there by Ash Mura, who is now extending it. A lot of people are taking the principles of Lean Startup and tweaking it and making it a little bit fit different genre, different areas.
Yeah.
Just like I am. I've taken the Lean Startup and I have the Lean Artist. So we've adapted the principles there to make it happen. But the fundamental principles are there. And the whole idea is with that, again, is you test, you create your hypothesis, you test, you quickly get it out, you build, you measure, and then you learn, and then you change. You want to fail fast and move on quickly. If I told anybody, the most important advice is to fail fast, readjust, don't get discouraged, but use that as a valuable tool to help you move forward on your ideas moving forward. And that's why I even tell artists right now, build an album, go make an album right now. Okay. That's a lot of work. Are we sure that people are going to want that album?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to say, it's art and I want to go make it. I'm not saying don't go make art, don't go do stuff, write, create stuff. But going in and spending, 6 months on building a full-blown album today, especially if you don't really have the market for it yet, it's not a wise decision from my point of view. You're better off, let's figure out what we're going to do, keep writing tunes, let's get them down, just throw them down, and let's start testing, getting a feel for what's going to work and who's your art audience and will they care about that? Because you can't adjust your thinking in the type of music or what you're doing. I'm not trying to say don't be true to your heart and try to be somebody else, because that can be the kiss of death. But you can do this much smarter now So my biggest advice today, the thing that I've learned most and my favorite tool is that tool at leanstack.com. It's called the Lean Canvas. And on that canvas, so anybody listening, is there's videos. So go in and read those, watch those videos, because it'll tell you how to fill it out. It's a one-page business plan, but this thing can help focus your what you're doing so much that it gives you a real good chance of success. You know, so my advice is join the lean startup movement from a business point of view.
Fantastic. No one's, you know, I've asked this for everybody that's been on, and no one's even come close to something like that. That's great. I'd love to hear new stuff. That's very cool, Scott.
All right, buddy. Well, hey, thanks so much, Bobby, for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. This has been great. I appreciate it. To find out more about Scott, you can look him up on Wikipedia, where he has a very, very nice page. You can also find out more about Ignited by going to ignited.network. So that's just Ignited, ignited.network, N-E-T-W-O-R-K. So there's no .com, .net, anything. It's ignited.network. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love getting your questions and comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.